We'll turn now to 1 Samuel chapter 2. We got partway through it last time. And one reason we had a bit of a problem last time because there's a very lengthy, the chapter ends with a lengthy prophecy that is given by some nondescript, unidentified man of God who came to Eli with a prophecy of judgment. And that prophecy, we see the man coming to him in verse 27, and then verses 28 through 36, which is a very long section of the chapter, is this prophecy. Well, we read the prophecy and made a few comments, but there's so many things to comment. I simply wasn't able to say everything I want to say about it. So let's read that section again to refresh ourselves. Beginning with verse 27, "Then a man of God came to Eli and said to him, 'Thus says the Lord, did I not clearly reveal myself to the house of your father when you were in Egypt in Pharaoh's house? Did I not choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to offer up upon my altar, to burn incense and to wear an ephod before me? And did I not give to the house of your father all the offerings of the children of Israel made by fire? Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering which I have commanded in my habitation and honor your sons more than me, to make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of Israel, my people? Therefore, the Lord God of Israel says, I said indeed that that your house and the house of your father would walk before me forever. But now the Lord says, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming that I will cut off your arm and the arm of your father's house, so that there will be not an old man in your house. You will see an enemy in my habitation, despite all the good which God does for Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. But any of your men whom I do not cut off from my altar shall consume your eyes and grieve your heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die in the flower of their age. Now this shall be a sign to you that will come upon your two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. Then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before my anointed forever. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left in your house will come and bow down before him for a piece of silver and a morsel of bread, and say, please put me in one of the priestly positions that I may eat a piece of bread.'" Now, the prophecy against Eli was said to be because he honors his sons more than God, and this he did by allowing his sons to continue to be in the priesthood, even though they were morally unqualified and were abusive of office. Eli had, as you will recall, rebuked his sons, had confronted them, but he did not restrain them, did not prevent them from continuing in the office. And therefore, he, in a sense, honored them by this decision. He allowed them to have their way, rather than standing jealously over the purity of the office of the priesthood and over the holiness of the calling to priesthood. Anyway, this God held against him and said, because you do this, there's going to be a judgment upon you and your house. Now, in verse 30, God said, I said indeed that your house and the house of your father would walk before me forever. Now, walk before me means as priests in the tabernacle, to walk in the tabernacle before God. And his father would be not just Aaron in this case. It probably was Aaron, but the particular branch of Aaron's house that Eli came through. And we don't actually have any record of which branch of Eli's, of Aaron's house, Eli came through. We don't have any genealogy for Eli. But Aaron could be the man. God said that Aaron's family would walk before God forever. And Eli apparently was the oldest son of the oldest son of the oldest son of the oldest son of the oldest son, going all the way back to Aaron, which would mean that he would generally, by right of birth, have the high priesthood, which is why he was high priest. Now, what God says here is, I've said that your house and your father's house would walk before me forever. However, he says, now far be it from me. For those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Apparently what he's saying, he's not revoking the promise he made to Aaron and to Aaron's house, but he is revoking Eli's portion. Eli, since he stood as the hereditary high priest, his son, his oldest son, would by natural succession, be the next high priest. But God was going to change that because Eli's oldest son and Eli himself had not adequately honored God, and therefore God was not going to honor them with the next succession in the priesthood. Now, he's not saying that there will no longer be priests of the house of Aaron, but he is saying that the natural succession will not go forward anymore because of the moral disqualifications of those who would stand in hereditary succession, and therefore he'll choose another priest, another descendant of Aaron from some other family line, and give the high priesthood to him. Now, what I find interesting is that God said, I said that your house and the house of your father walk before me forever, but now far be it from me. In other words, I may have said this, and I may have said it was forever, but I want you to understand that I am not holding myself to that without conditions. There are people today who say that God's promises, some of them, are unconditional. Of course, a lot of the people who feel that Israel, even while they are in rebellion against God, even rejecting Christ, that they are still God's chosen people because God made certain unconditional promises to Abraham and his seed. This is what they say. But I'm not sure there are such things as unconditional promises made by God. Certainly the idea that Eli's family would walk before God as priests forever was stated without conditions. And yet God says, but even though I didn't state the conditions, I want you to know I have conditions. Those who honor me, I'll honor in the way that I said I would. And those who don't honor me, I won't. I'll dishonor them. That is to say, you still have to meet the moral conditions for the promise to be fulfilled. God has made a promise, and it's an eternal promise. But if you don't meet the conditions for the promise, then you can't have them. And I believe that this is true of all of God's promises, even those that appear to be unconditional. They may be stated without stating the conditions. There may be unmentioned conditions, but they are implied. So that when God said to Abram and his seed, or to Israel, you are my people forever, or whatever, I'll give you the land forever, there are other times, actually, that God actually stated conditions for that. In Deuteronomy 28 and other places, he stated conditions for them keeping the land. He doesn't state the conditions every time he makes the promise, though. They are implied. What this makes clear is that God can make a promise without stating conditions, and yet when the implied conditions have not been met, he can say, didn't meet the conditions, you're out. And that's what he said to Eli in his house here. God always deals this way with people. Those who honor him, God honors. There's no special category of people who can be honored by God even though they dishonor God. Jew or some other thing. You know, this is relevant also to the issue of eternal security. Because a lot of people just believe that, you just say a sinner's prayer sometime when you're little, and then you're in, no matter what you do, you can live for the devil the rest of your life, and you still go to heaven. Really? That's not what God says. God says, those who honor me, I will honor. Those who don't honor me, I won't. And it's quite obvious that there are people who've said sinner's prayers in youth, but in the rest of their life, they don't honor God, and he won't honor them. There's not any unconditional grants here. No relationship of any value with any parties is unconditional. Even a marriage relationship is not really entirely unconditional. If one of the spouses commits adultery, there are grounds for divorce. Of course, the innocent spouse can forgive and can say, even though you have not met the conditions here, I'm going to hope for restoration of the relationship. But there are grounds for divorce. Now, it's interesting, when marriage vows are made, no one mentions the conditions. Do you ever notice that? Ever been to a wedding where they said, I'm forsaking all others and going to cleave only to you in sickness and in health, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, as long as we both shall live, unless you commit adultery. I've never heard that attached to the vows. And yet, almost all societies, including biblical society, including biblical teaching, allows that adultery would be an exception to this until death business. But the conditions are not stated. They are implied. Likewise, when God made promises to Israel or to anyone else, to us, and says, you have eternal life. You are eternally my people, or whatever. You can have the land forever. There are other passages that state, this is conditional, of course. Conditional upon faith. Conditional upon, those who honor me. The assumption is, when I make these promises, that you're going to honor me. I'm going to honor my promises, he implies. I'm expected to honor your side of it. And if so, this is an ongoing thing forever. Of course, if you bail out on this deal, it's a different story. And of course, that's how any relationship is. You can't really have a serious relationship with any intelligent party that is unconditional in the sense that no matter what they do, you just keep smiling and keep friendly with them, even if they're stabbing you in the back and your mate's, you know, running around with every whoremonger in town and so forth. And I mean, you can still have this, a semblance of a relationship, but it isn't really a, the relationship's on the rocks. You can hope for restoration, but you can't call it a good relationship. No relationship between moral and intelligent parties can exist in a positive sense unconditionally. There has to be agreement on both sides. It takes two to be in a relationship. And so a relationship with God, as I would say, it takes both parties. God, He's made His intentions clear. He'll never default. He'll never be unfaithful. He keeps His promises. But if you default on yours, then the relationship is crushed. And that's what happened with Israel, as Jesus pointed out, and John the Baptist, and Paul, and many others, and even the prophets in the Old Testament did. Made it clear, Hosea, that since Israel had gone after idols, they were no longer God's people. Hosea said that in the Old Testament. Israel was not God's people in Hosea chapter 1. God had disowned them. They took them back, but He did disown them. So, relationship, fulfillment of God's promises to man. There are conditions. Sometimes they're stated and sometimes they're not stated. When they are not stated, they're implied. Here's a good example. God said, all the house of Aaron, they shall walk before me as priests forever. And He says, wait a minute here. You aren't measuring up. You guys are disqualified. You're not honoring me. Well, that changes things here. I didn't state those conditions, but you should have known. And it only makes sense that when you have a relationship with someone, suppose I made a promise to someone that I'll buy their car and I make payments on it for $100 a month. So they give me the car and I make the payments faithfully. But then they come over at night and sneak and steal the car back. And now they have the car. I don't get it back from them and they still want me to make the payments on it. Well, I say, well, wait a minute, something's changed here. You know, I made this promise in good faith and I'm honest. You know, but I expect the car for the payments. You know, I'm not going to give you the payments and have the car too. I mean, this is a purchase here. So if you've got your car back illicitly and you expect me to pay what I contracted to pay, I think there's been a change in the situation here. You know, and it's not that I'm a covenant breaker. It's that it implied that I will make these payments so long as I get the car. If you take the car back from me, then I'm not going to make the payments. It's not my fault. And God is, you know, we need to understand this because so many people just see salvation as a unilateral kind of thing. And we think that by thinking of salvation that way, we're honoring the grace of God. You know, well, you know, God is so gracious. Salvation is all of God. It's all His doing. We don't have anything to do with it. It's just all of grace. And if you give man any part of it, if you give man any responsibility, some people are going to say, well, then you're making salvation works. You're making yourself a participant in your own salvation. You're getting some of the glory for your own salvation because you had to contribute something to it. No, it has to be all of grace. It has to be all of God. If it's anything other than that, then God doesn't get all the glory, they think. Well, that might sound philosophically good. It just isn't biblical. It's a shame. I mean, it sounds very nice, but it just isn't what the Bible says. It'd be nice if it did, especially nice for the backslider who's rejected God and cursing God and living in total sin. It'd be wonderful if that was true. Wonderful for him. Wouldn't be very good for God. God sure gets the wrong end of that deal. But the Bible indicates that salvation is a relationship with God, and relationships have to be maintained. And it's not like we buy it. We don't earn it. He doesn't owe it to us. He doesn't owe it to us to accept us into His family or to marry us or any of those things that the Bible likens it to. But He also doesn't, it's not unconditional. Those who honor God, He honors. Those who despise Him, He lightly esteems. This is a principle. We see it in this particular prophecy that's given. But it's also very much a principle throughout Scripture. And even if it was Scriptures, one could almost be able to deduce it just on the basis that, well, relationships obviously aren't unilateral. They're not just one directional. Unilateral means one direction. And so we see it again here in this statement from this prophet, from God. Behold, verse 31 says, the days are coming out. I'll cut off your arm. I'm going to cut off your house. And most important, he says in this latter section, is that he says, in 34, this shall be a sign to you that will come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and one day they shall die. And of course, they did, and later. But verse 35 may be something that a lot of people just don't know quite how it was fulfilled. Verse 35 says, then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, I will build him a sure house. He shall walk before my anointed forever. Well, who is this faithful priest? This faithful priest, you might be inclined to think of the faithful priest as Jesus. You know, I mean, some might think, oh, this is a messianic prophecy. And that would be an interesting fulfillment. You know, basically saying the Aaronic priesthood represented by Eli will eventually be replaced by someone entirely differently. Jesus, a priest after the order of Melchizedek, someone who does not come up through the house of Aaron. So that God would be scrapping the Aaronic priesthood altogether in favor of something else. And in saying in verse 36 that it shall come to pass that everyone who's left in your house will come and bow down to him. It's tempting to think this is a reference to Christ and how in order to be saved the Jews have to come bow down to him as the new high priest and so forth. If we're informed otherwise of the fulfillment of this prophecy, that would be a very attractive interpretation. But we are informed otherwise of it. If you look over at 1 Kings chapter 2, when Solomon first began reigning after David's death, he actually brought about the fulfillment of this prophecy. It says in 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 26 and 27, this is after David died, and to Abiathar, the priest, the king said, Solomon said, go to Anathoth and to your own fields, for you are worthy of death. This is because Abiathar sided with Absalom during the rebellion, or it's not Absalom, but with Adonijah during the rebellion against Solomon's reign. And Abiathar had been the high priest, and now he sided with the wrong guy. And so, as a traitor against Solomon, he was worthy of death. But Solomon did not determine to kill him right off. He said, but I will not put you to death at this time, because you carried the ark of the Lord God before my father David, because you were afflicted every time my father was afflicted. Abiathar actually had been faithful to David in Absalom's rebellion, but had defected when Adonijah rebelled. So Solomon removed Abiathar from being priest to the Lord, that he might fulfill the word of the Lord which he spoke concerning the house of Eli at Shiloh. Okay, well, that's what we just have been reading in 1 Samuel chapter 2. So apparently Abiathar was a descendant of Eli. And by putting him out of the priesthood and replacing him with someone unrelated to him, this fulfilled the prophecy that was made. But who is the new priest? Who is the godly priest that replaced him? Well, that's also in this chapter, 1 Kings 2, verse 35. The king put Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, in his place over the army, and the king put Zadok, the priest, in the place of Abiathar. Zadok was the godly priest that replaced Abiathar as the high priest, and he's the one, apparently, who is the faithful priest mentioned in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 35. The Zadokite priests after that time were godly, and they were well spoken of throughout the prophets. And even an order of priests was named after them, after Zadok. They called themselves the Sadducees, which is a word that is etymologically based on the word Zadok. Of course, the Sadducees eventually themselves became rather corrupt and crucified Jesus. But Zadok himself and the order of priests under him for a long time was faithful. And Eli's family under Abiathar was put out of the priesthood and replaced with Zadok, the faithful priest. So that's the fulfillment of that prediction. Now, Eli will hear another prediction of the same sort, but this time it'll come from Samuel the prophet. In chapter 3, then the boy Samuel ministered to the Lord before Eli. And the word of the Lord was rare in those days, and there was no widespread revelation. That means there was no actual prophet speaking publicly, widespread revelation being made public to the people, as later came to be true when Samuel became a prophet. Now, Samuel becomes a prophet in this chapter, but he's the first, I guess, what we could call public prophet since Moses. The man of God who brought the prophecy to Eli in the previous chapter, as far as you know, it's the only prophecy he ever gave. It was a personal prophecy given privately to Eli. He was not occupying some kind of an office of a prophet. He's just a man who got a message from God and brought it to Eli. But there's no widespread revelation. There was no public prophecy being given. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Now, the word that came to Eli in chapter 2 was an example of one of those rare times when God actually gave a revelation to somebody. But that was rare. There was no office of a prophet. There was no individual who could regularly be counted on to speak to Israel concerning what God had to say. That's what was about to change with the coming of Samuel. And it came to pass at that time, while Eli was lying down in his place, and when his eyes had begun to grow so dim that he could not see, and before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and while Samuel was lying down asleep, the Lord called Samuel, and he said, "Here I am." Now, before we go into this very well-known story and talk about the details of it, I just want to comment about verse 3. And I don't have very little enlightening to say about verse 3. I just want to point out that it's a peculiar verse. It says, "And before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord where the ark of God was." Now, it sounds like, you know, this is talking about a particular time. Is this a time of day? It talks about when Eli was lying down. That was apparently nighttime. And Samuel was lying down to sleep, verse 3 also says. But in connection with what time this was, when God called to Samuel, it says it was before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord while the ark of God, where the ark of God was. Went out? The lamp of God was supposed to stay on, you know, supposed to be burning. Does it mean that the practice of keeping the lamp burning was being neglected by Eli? Did they allow it to go out at night and relight it in the morning? Is that what it's talking about? Were they trying to spare oil because the tithes of the people were not all they should be, and they had a little too little oil, so they let the lamp go out at night? I don't know. But it hardly seems worthy of mention. If it's only talking about the lamp stand in the tabernacle and has no other meaning besides that, I mean, why would that be relevant to mention here? I mean, it might be a fact that they allowed the lamp to go out. That wouldn't be good, but why would it mention that this dream happened, or this appearance of God to Samuel happened before the lamp went out in the tabernacle? I would guess, and I can't be certain about this, and I'm not trying to be very profound, but I've always wrestled with this question in this verse. Is this telling us something about the lampstand in the tabernacle going out at night, or is it talking about something, is it to be understood spiritually? No doubt the lampstand in the tabernacle did represent something spiritual. It was like God's light, God's revelation given to Israel. In the New Testament, the seven churches are like seven lampstands in the book of Revelation, chapter 1 and verse 20. And the church is the light of the world. The church is the agent of God's revelation to a dark world, and therefore is compared with the lampstand. I suspect that the lampstand in the tabernacle represented the same thing, only with reference to Israel, that God's light, God's revelation to the darkened world was given through Israel. But when it talks about the lamp, it sounds like it was about to. And perhaps what it is trying to say here is that Israel was about to have no more light. Revelations from God were rare. Apparently the nation was in apostasy. We don't know very much about the state of the nation at large at this time. We know it was during the latter part of the Judges. And from reading the book of Judges, we know that the knowledge of God was not well communicated and not widely followed in the period of the Judges. The only family we've read about in 1 Samuel, well, there's two families, each family, and they're pretty bad. Well, Samuel's family, his parents were good. So from just what we read in 1 Samuel, we wouldn't know much about the general state of the nation of Israel. But we are perhaps to assume that Samuel's godly family were very unusual. They were a rare remnant family. Whereas Eli's family may have been much more typical. And the light of Israel was about going out, that God was about ready to give up on them and give them no more light. But he decided to give him one more chance. He'll call a young man to be a prophet. And then the light of the knowledge of God can continue to come to Israel and through Israel. And so we read of God doing so, calling Samuel. I don't know, I don't want to over-spiritualize that, but like I said, I've always wondered, what does it mean, before the lamp went out in the tabernacle, God called Samuel? It could just be telling us what time of night it was, but that doesn't really tell us, because we don't read anywhere in the law of a time of night when the lamp was supposed to be going out. So we don't know when that would have been. It doesn't inform us much there, whether it was the middle of the night or early in the evening or whatever. But it may be given as more of a spiritual indicator that Israel was about ready to be snuffed as far as the light that she was receiving and shedding to the world around her, until God called Samuel to be a prophet. So the Lord called Samuel, and Samuel said, "Here I am." So he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." And he said, "I did not call. Lie down again." And he went and lay down. And the Lord called yet again, "Samuel." So Samuel rose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." And he answered, "I did not call, my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor was the word of the Lord yet revealed to him. Now, when it says he didn't know the Lord, it doesn't mean that he wasn't pious and wasn't a believer and so forth, or wasn't saved. I think it just means that God had not revealed himself to him, as it says in that latter part, and therefore he didn't have this firsthand communion with God, such as he later was known for. And the Lord called Samuel again the third time. Then he arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you did call me. But Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you must say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Now, this interaction between Samuel and Eli, a friend of mine who's a preacher, actually, he might be a prophet. I don't know. He's a prophetic kind of a guy. I don't know if he's a prophet. But he saw some very interesting things in scriptures that I never saw. Maybe not validly. But he used to talk about this passage, and I was quite impressed with what he had to say about it. He felt like Eli in this situation represents much of the institutional religion. Today it would be much of institutional Christianity. Sleeping. The light is about gone out. And instead of tending to the light, the priest is sleeping. And so God, someone else, some youth, some child, some non-ordained person, some person who's not really part of the establishment, to start speaking fresh, to start revealing things, lost things or important things that the church, the institutional really, is not really maintaining. There's been too much corruption in the institution. And while there's been, you know, some of the best men in the institution, like Eli, they're concerned about the corruption. They do little about it. In fact, they're content just to sleep. And when God begins to speak, it's not the leader of the institution who hears God. It's some child. It's some person who would seem to be hold no status whatsoever in this institution. And when he begins to hear from God, Samuel first goes and talks to Eli about it. Wakes him up. Says, "Hey, God, you called me." He thinks that he's supposed to hear from God through Eli, but he says, "You called me." And Eli at first just wants to sleep, and he doesn't want to be bothered by it. Eventually, Eli perceives that God is speaking to the young man and tells him, "This is God talking to you." But Eli doesn't stay up to find out what God will say. He wants to go back to sleep. He just says, "When God talks, tell God, I'll listen, speak, Lord, your servant hears." But Eli still wants to sleep. Of course, the next morning he's curious to know what it's about because he suspects it's about him, and sure enough it is. And the prophecy turns out to be against Eli, against the house of Eli. And my friend who used to preach about that felt, and this is many years ago now, I haven't seen this man for years, but he felt like there is a parallel to that in the institution of Christianity, not just now, but at all times in Christian history, that the institution tends toward institutionalization. The institution tends toward spiritual laxity. We can certainly see through the Dark Ages, but we don't have to go back that far. We can see it in modern times, that the organized religion often is not hearing from God and not even maintaining its duties of upholding what God has said before. And God's up a new movement. Wesley was like that in the Anglican Church. By the way, Wesley remained an Anglican to the day of his death. But the movement he started became a separate movement, and it's called the Methodist today. But he was within the institutional Church of England. But he was hearing from God, I believe, things that the Anglican Church was neglecting. And he called people back to holiness by the thousands. And in fact, he brought tremendous revival throughout England. And that kind of thing happens. You can see it again and again. Most revivals happen that way. Very few revivals have come up through the preaching of the institutional pastors. Some have. Jonathan Edwards would be an example of a revival that came through the preaching of a pastor in an institutional church. But Finney and Wesley and Moody and Billy Graham and so forth, they're not spokesmen for any institutional organization. I mean, they have their own organizations, but they're not part of the institutional church. They may attend church. I'm not saying that they're totally separate from it. But the voice that has been raised up separate from, and we call those parachurch organizations. And Wilkerson, who started Teen Challenge, and Lauren Cunningham, who started YWAM. Both of those guys were in the Assemblies of God denomination, and both basically left the denomination, or left the institution, because what God was doing through them didn't quite fit what the organization wanted. So they started their own what's called parachurch organizations. I think Samuel was kind of parachurch. He was serving, of course, in the tabernacle, but he wasn't a clergyman there. He wasn't ordained. He was a priestly family, it would seem, but he was in line to be the next priest necessarily. But God called him because he was young and pure and he was dedicated to God, and Eli was old and his form of religion was compromised. And so God spoke to Samuel, and what he spoke to Samuel was about the demise of Eli's family, which, of course, we had already read about from another prophet in the previous chapter. So Eli finally says, Samuel, when you hear the Lord again, just say, speak, Lord, your servant hears. So Samuel went and lay down in his place, and the Lord came and stood and called, as at other times, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel answered, speak, for your servant hears. Then the Lord said to Samuel, behold, I will do something in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from the beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows. Because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them. And therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. Now, does this mean that God would not forgive Eli's sin? Does it mean Eli went to hell? Eli is not in heaven today? I suspect that Eli is in heaven today. I suspect that Eli died a man of faith. He seemed to be far more devoted to God than his sons were. He was not a very responsible father, and he did neglect his duty, both as a parent and as a high priest. But certainly the whole narrative describes him as a man who was essentially committed to God and loved God, and the ultimate tragedy that caused him to die was not hearing that his sons had died, but that the ark had been captured. That's what really got him. And he seemed to really love the Lord. And when it says, the sin of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering, I think what it means is that the judgment, that is the temporal judgment on Eli's house, his rejection from priesthood, his sons and grandsons' rejection from priesthood, that's irreversible. No amount of sacrifice and offerings will somehow change God's mind about this and atone for the sin of their family and cause him to give them back the role of priesthood that they've lost. But as far as individuals in that family, I believe they could be saved by faith the same as anyone else was saved in those days. Remember, sacrifices were never the means by which people were really saved. They were symbolic of a greater atonement through Christ, but that atonement was received through faith, and I think Eli probably died in faith, though his household was rejected permanently from the priesthood. So Samuel lay down until morning and opened the doors of the house of the Lord, and Samuel was afraid to tell Eli the vision. And Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. And he answered, here I am. And Eli said, what is the thing that the Lord has said to you? Please do not hide it from me. God do so to you and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the things that he said to you. You're probably familiar from Ruth and from the book of Judges with this expression, God do so and more. You've probably encountered that a few times already. It's a Hebraism in the Old Testament that is basically invoking a curse. Usually people did it on themselves. God do so to me and more, if I do not do such and such. Ruth said that to Naomi. God do so to me and more if anything but death separates me from you. And there, David used the expression that, later on. In the Old Testament, we find it a lot. It's an awkward expression to us, but it was probably accompanied by some gesture. Many scholars feel there may have been sort of a drawing of the finger across the throat, like may my throat be slit and worse than that if I don't do what I'm promising to do. I mean, the idea being, do so to me, it doesn't explain what it is that should be done, and therefore it may have been indicated by some gesture. May such and such happen to me, and worse, and more, if I don't keep my promise. In this case, Eli is turning around on Samuel. God do so to you, and more, if you don't tell me every word of it. So Samuel told him everything, and he hid nothing from him. And Eli said, it is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. Now, Eli could hardly be happy about the news. I mean, but it wasn't new. It wasn't new news. I mean, chapter 2 had told him his sons are going to die in one day, and God's angry with him, and he's going to thrust his family from the priesthood. So what Samuel had been told is really more or less just a confirmation of that. And one might ask, well, why was Samuel told it? Was he told that so that he could tell Eli? Well, Samuel didn't even intend to tell Eli until Eli pressed him on it. Doubt God told Samuel because Samuel was going to be the leader after Eli's death. And God let Samuel in on it. Samuel was one of God's friends. God confided in Samuel about this because Samuel was going to have a role to play in replacing Eli and his sons. Well, it says, Eli was basically resigned to it, I guess. He said, it's the Lord, let him do what seems good to him. So Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. A Hebraism that apparently means that every word he spoke hit the target. The image being, you shoot an arrow, it doesn't fall short of a target to the ground, but it hits the mark. And Samuel, when he would say things, they were true. When he predicted things, they happened. God didn't allow any of his words to fail in their intended purpose. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba — Dan to Beersheba just means the whole country, Dan's the northernmost part and Beersheba the southernmost boundary — they all knew that Samuel had been established as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again in Shiloh, which apparently he had stopped doing, or his flame was flickering there. For the Lord revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. So, in the beginning of chapter 3, we find that the word of the Lord was scarce. There was no open vision, no public revelation from God to Israel. At the beginning of chapter 4, there is. Samuel has been established as a prophet of the Lord, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. He was a public spokesman for God. And therefore, when Israel needed guidance from God, there was a man who, anytime necessary, could get a word from the Lord and speak in that way. I have expressed my sentiment before that I don't believe that we have any prophets in the church today of this time. I believe that New Testament prophets, like Agabus, may have in fact been of this type. I'm not sure. We don't know enough about New Testament prophets. They are mentioned several times, and we still don't get much of a composite drawing in the New Testament of what a New Testament prophet did or does. But certainly the few things we learn about them would appear that they were very much like Old Testament prophets. And when I say I don't think we necessarily have any prophets of this sort in the church today, I'm not trying to say that the gift of prophecy is not still happening. I believe that just like a man of God came to Eli, who was not himself — the man of God was not a prophet in the sense that Samuel became a prophet, but he was a man who heard from God and gave a word from the Lord, a word in season to the religious establishment or whatever in that case. But Samuel was different. Samuel is a guy who anytime God wanted to communicate, he spoke through him. Anytime that the king later on needed a word from God, he'd go to Samuel and could count on it. Samuel would have one. Samuel could speak to him from the Lord. A prophet in the Old Testament was somebody who was regularly, consistently the official spokesman for God. I believe in the gift of prophecy in the church today, but I don't believe that anyone in the church is in that role of the official spokesman for God, for all God's people, and can always be counted on every time he speaks from God to tell exactly what God is saying. There are many who are hoping to see restoration of that prophetic ministry in the modern church in the last days, as they would. But I don't know that there's anything in the Bible to anticipate that or any need for it. I do believe that God can still speak prophetically through individuals, but I have my doubts whether any individual today is a prophet in the sense that the Bible uses that word both in the Old and the New Testament. Samuel was a prophet. His word — everyone knew he was established as a prophet. And his words, every time he spoke, none of them fell to the ground. He never hit it wrong once. And God honored his words, and he became famous, nationally famous. The whole nation began to listen to his oracles. Verse 1 of chapter 4 goes on. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped in Aphek. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel, and when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. Now, we don't read why they were defeated. The Israelites themselves were surprised and wondered why they were defeated. We have to assume, though, we read between the lines, that Israel was basically kind of apostate. This was, as we saw, the period of the judges, a time of general apostasy. God had only just begun to speak again through a prophet, but that doesn't mean that Israel was responding en masse in obedience to the prophet's words. And Israel was still not receiving God's favor, and therefore they lost to their enemies here, just like they did many times in the book of Judges. They came under the bondage of the Philistines and the Midianites and the Moabites and a whole bunch of other people. Here they lose to the Philistines again. And about 4,000 of the Jews are killed, which is a bad loss.
And when the people had come to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. And they shouted for joy that the Ark was coming. And they got hyped to go out back to battle with the Ark. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before." The Israelites apparently had never taken the Ark to battle before, and now the Philistines thought, "Now we're really in trouble. Woe to us, who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness." Notice they associate the divine power with the Ark, that piece of furniture. You know, the pagans were superstitious about such things. Obviously, the Jews were too at this point. And they believed that God's favor, you know, God hadn't gone to battle with them for some reason. So they figured, well, we'll take the Ark, then God will go with us. And kind of a wrong assumption. If God isn't with them without the Ark in battle, it's because he's got something against them. And taking the Ark along isn't going to change the fact that he's got something against them. But both the Philistines and the Jews were somewhat superstitious about these things. And the Philistines encouraged each other, verse 9, "Be strong and conduct yourself like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. Every man fled to his tent, and there was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. And, of course, we read of this story largely because of its fulfillment of the prophecy in chapter 2, that Hophni and Phinehas would die in one day. As it turned out, one of the wives of them died the same day, and so did Eli. So it was a great slaughter. 30,000 foot soldiers plus all the priests died. And one of their wives died that day, too. Now, there's more that happened than is mentioned here. You will remember, I trust, back in chapter 2, that one of the parts of the prophecy that was given to Eli by that unnamed man of God in verse 31 says, "Behold, the days are coming that I will cut off your arm and the arm of your father's house, so there will not be an old man in your house." And, wrong verse, a little further down, he says that you will see, let me see, what verse is that? "You'll see an enemy in my habitation." It's right in there. I thought it was that verse, but it's not. Oh, it's the next verse, 32. "And you will see an enemy in my habitation." My habitation means the tabernacle, God's habitation. And the enemy in the habitation, as it turned out, was the Philistines. Now, we don't read of it in chapter 4. We only read of them taking the Ark, and that apparently from the battlefield. We don't read of the Philistines going to Shiloh and plundering the tabernacle. But apparently that happened. Once they obtained the Ark, they figured, hey, we're on a roll. Let's get the rest of their sacred furniture. And so they went and they plundered the tabernacle. And we know they did. Because of later references to this. In Jeremiah chapter 7, for example. Even before that. We can go before that. In Psalms 78. I'd like to turn you there. Psalm 78, verses 58 through 64. 58 through 64. This is a bit of a retelling of this portion of the history. It says, "They provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their carved images. When God heard this, he was furious and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he had placed among men, and delivered his strength," meaning the Ark, "into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. He also gave his people over to the sword, and he was furious with his inheritance, and fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation." One reason is because one of their widows died and didn't have time to lament. This is a more poetic description of what happened in this battle. Instead of mentioning the Ark was taken, it says God's strength and God's glory was captured by the enemies. It does talk about the priests falling by the sword. It talks about fire consuming the young men, and it probably was not literal fire, but that's a symbol of judgment. It was God's judgment, because it says in verse 58, God was provoked by their high places and their carved images. So apparently, although Samuel doesn't tell us this, this period of time was a time when Israel was still worshiping carved images. I mentioned Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 7 makes reference to this also in chapter 7, verse 12. God says through Jeremiah to Israel, at a time when they were trusting that the temple in Jerusalem could never be destroyed because it was a holy site, God says, "But go now to my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel." Now, apparently what happened at Shiloh was when the ark was captured, Shiloh was plundered by the Philistines also, and the tent was left intact, probably a bit damaged, and it was moved to a place called Nob, which is mentioned in chapter 21 of 1 Samuel. It's a place that David stopped by to get the showbread on his way fleeing from Saul. But the ark was, the tabernacle was moved from Shiloh after this point. Yes, yes it was. And one way we know that this plundering of Shiloh must have taken place about the same time the ark was captured is that when the ark came back shortly later, a few months later probably, they didn't take it back to Shiloh. It was kept at somebody's house, Obed-Edom's house, for a long time, for years, actually. And that would seem strange if the tabernacle is still standing in Shiloh, where you get the ark back, you take it back to the Holy of Holies where it goes. But they didn't. And we know from other sources that Shiloh was destroyed, and it must have been at this time. The Philistines took the ark and destroyed Shiloh, the city of Shiloh, and apparently what was left of the tabernacle was moved later on to Nob. So it was a big calamity for Israel. Verse 12, "Then a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head." This is before the Philistines got there, apparently. "Now when he came, there was Eli sitting in a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God." That is, he was nervous about them taking the ark out in battle. There was good reason for him to be nervous. First of all, they just lost a battle to the Philistines maybe the day before. So they were not exactly on a roll. And they took the ark, which was not customary. You don't usually take it out of the Holy of Holies, where it belongs. And he also could not help but remember that two prophecies went against him, against his house, and his sons were carrying the ark out there, and they're both supposed to die in one day. I'm sure that Eli could put two and two together. This could be the occasion when they might die. And maybe worse of all, the ark is vulnerable too, because they've got it out on the battlefield. And it says his heart was trembling because of the ark. He was more concerned about the ark than he was about his sons. After all, he knew his sons were going to die. Maybe not in this battle, but he was told they'd die. But he had not been told that the ark would necessarily be taken, but he began to worry about that. By the way, why was the ark taken? What was wrong with it? Why didn't God honor the ark when the Jews took it out to battle? When they came into the Promised Land and conquered Jericho and these other places, they carried the ark in front of them. Why didn't it work this time? Well, it seems obvious. The Jews were counting on a religious relic rather than a relationship with God. They had lost their first 4,000 men the day before because God was angry at them for their idolatry. There was a problem in the relationship. And they didn't ever think of it in those terms. They thought, oh, well, they were just superstitious. They didn't think of their security being related to their being on good terms with God. It was just this ark was an article that powerful things had been associated with before. And even the Philistines and the Jews together saw it as a powerful artifact. But God was not with Israel anymore when they took the ark than when they didn't. They were relying on this religious institution of the ark rather than on a current, up-to-date relationship with God, keeping on good terms with Him. And so God didn't pay any attention to the ark. He didn't care. The ark is not God, but both Israel and the Philistines were looking at it as if it was. And God didn't honor their superstition. He allowed it to be taken into captivity. Now, it says in verse 14, "When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, 'What does this tumult mean?' And the man came hastily and told Eli." Eli was 98 years old, so he didn't exactly get cut off in the flower of his age here. Almost 100 years old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am he who came from the battle, and I fled today from the battle line." And he said, "What happened, my son?" So the messenger answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines. There has been a great slaughter among the people. Also your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been captured." Now there's four bits of news here, each one worse than the previous. First of all, Israel has fled from the Philistines. They lost the battle. But worse than that, there's been a great slaughter of the Jews. You could have lost the battle without having a great slaughter. So that's worse yet. And your two sons are dead. And the ark has been captured. Notice it's that last item, more than any of the others, that got to Eli. It says it happened when he made mention of the ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel for 40 years, as all the judges appeared to judge for 40 years. Eli fell backward and broke his neck. The impression is that he died of a broken neck. Why he fell backward is not altogether clear. He may have had a stroke. He may have had a mild heart attack. He didn't die of stroke or heart attack. He died of a broken neck, it appears. But he could have, the news was so shocking and so... it was what he had greatly feared. You know, his worst trepidation came to reality, that he may have had a stroke or a heart attack, or he may have just fainted. He may have just fainted. His courage and his strength just failed him. He fell over backward and broke his neck and died of that cause. Now, that's not the last death to happen on that day. Verse 19, now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was with child, due to be delivered. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth. Of course, trauma, especially in those late stages of pregnancy, can cause onset of labor, and that happened. And her labor pains came upon her, and about the time of her death, because she died in childbirth, like Rachel did, the women who stood by her said to her, "Do not fear, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer, nor did she regard it. And the name of the child... She named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel." Ichabod means no glory. The glory has departed from Israel because the ark of God had been captured and because of her father-in-law and her husband. Now, the glory had departed from Israel because of the ark of God captured. Does that mean that the glory of God was the ark of God? And because the ark was captured, the glory went with it? She may have meant it so. But if she did, she was incorrect. But it was correct that the glory had departed, in one sense anyway. That God's favor on Israel was at a low ebb, was certain. And the fact that the ark was taken was an evidence of that. He would have never allowed such a thing to happen if he wasn't already of a mind to judge Israel. The glory didn't depart because the ark departed. And she and other Israelites might have thought of it that way. But if the glory had in fact departed at all, it was before the ark departed, and the departure of the ark was an evidence of it, that God had even given them over to the point where the ark was captured. Now, the fact is the glory of the Lord had not fully departed because Samuel was there, and he was beginning to receive revelations from God. God was basically replacing confidence in the ritual of the ark with a man with a living relationship with God who could speak the living oracles of God to people, which is far more essential in a person's or a nation's relationship with God, that they maintain an open ear to what God is saying, rather than that they maintain a religious institution with its furniture and all that stuff. You know, I mean, the glory had in one sense departed, but it was going to come up again. God was going to restore Israel through Samuel. And by the way, God didn't abandon the ark altogether either, as we see in the next chapter. Anyway, this child was named Ichabod, which means no glory, because the glory, she said, has departed. And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." Now, chapter 5. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. This is a Philistine city. They captured it at Ebenezer and took it to Ashdod, one of their five cities in the land of Canaan. When the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. Now, Dagon is known from archaeology to have been a fish god. It was in the shape of a fish. Some say it had a human body and a fish head. Others say it had a fish head, that is, a human head and a fish body. There's different opinions. I think it was a fish-headed god with a mostly a human-type body. Of course, this is just an idol. We're talking about an image here. An image that was representing a man's kind of body with a fish head. And the Philistines were seagoing people. They actually had come from the island of Crete originally, and they were maritime people. They were sailors. And they had sometime prior to this, hundreds of years prior to this, Philistines had come over from Crete and settled on the coast of what was then Canaan. And when Israel conquered Canaan, they didn't conquer the Philistines, who resided in five cities along the coast. And those five cities each had a lord. The lords of the Philistines were five in number. And Ashdod was one of the Philistine cities. And perhaps it is because they were a maritime people that they had a fish god. Perhaps they roughly analogous to Neptune or something among the Romans, but the god of the sea. I don't know that much about what Dagon represented, but he was the chief god worshipped by the Philistines. Now, they had a temple to Dagon in Ashdod. And so they brought the ark there and figured, well, we've got this religious thing. Let's put it in the temple of Dagon. And they probably meant that as a deliberate blasphemy against Jehovah. You know, in those days it was believed that if in war one nation beat another nation, that it was because the winning nation's god was more powerful than the losing nation's god was. That these things, you know, the most powerful god would protect his people from the people of another god who's not as powerful. And if you win in war, it's because your god was more powerful. And capturing the ark was only a confirmation of the Philistines that their god, Dagon, must be more powerful than the god of the Jews who was represented in the ark. So they brought the ark, which had been used for the worship of Jehovah, and brought it into the temple of Dagon as if to, you know, to suggest that Dagon is now to be honored by this ark. Dagon is the one who's shown his superiority over this ark. But of course they found the reverse to be true, as we read on. It says, verse 3, "And when the people of Ashdod arose early in the morning, there was Dagon, fallen on his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him up on his place again." It seems like they should have, well, that's amazing. You know, here's Dagon prostrate before the ark. You know, every knee shall bow, even that of the statues of Dagon. And so they said, well, it must have been an earthquake. Let's put it back up again. Somehow it fell over. "So when they arose early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on its face to the ground a second time before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were broken off on the threshold. Only the torso of Dagon was left of it." So not only was the statue fallen the second time, but actually its head, it was decapitated, and its hands were cut off. And hands and head. But Jezebel was eaten by dogs, and only her hands and what? Feet were left, is that right? Or was her head left too? I don't recall. It's been a while now since I read it. Her hands were left, I think, after the dogs ate her. I don't remember what other parts of her body. There might have been, I think there was one other thing left, her feet or something, but wasn't much left of her. Palms. It was Palm Sunday. Oh, yes. the hands and the head are frequently combined in Scripture as having some relevance, usually to a man's thoughts and his works, the works of his hands and the thoughts of his head, you know. And there's many places in Scripture we'll find those two items joined. It may be, therefore, significant, though I'm not sure, that Dagon's head and hands were cut off. He was no longer able to mastermind or to do any works for the people. I mean, the image was he was impotent. The people who looked to him to guard them, to protect them, he had neither the hands to help nor the head to be aware of their needs. He was a dumb idol and an impotent idol. And this was demonstrated symbolically by God removing his hands and his head and putting them on the threshold of the door. Now, I'm not sure why on the threshold. I'm sure if I was more clever, I could think of some great reason why the threshold was a good place for it. But it's just a fact that when they found the idol down, they put his head and his hands on the threshold of the door into the temple there of Dagon. I can't tell you why that would be important. What's that?
Trying to get out.
Yeah, I didn't quite make it out the door. "Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor any who come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day." So it became a memorial in a sense that even though the Philistines would have no desire to memorialize the superiority of Jehovah over their God, yet because Dagon's head and hands were on the threshold, the Philistines forever afterwards thought of the threshold as a sacred place. And they would never step on it. They'd step over it to go in and out, but they wouldn't step on the threshold. Now, the writer tells us this practice of the Philistines, even to this day, of course not our day because they're not around anymore, but the days this is written, reminds us of this occasion when the superiority of God, of the Jewish God, over the Philistine God was dramatically demonstrated. It's like the Philistines memorialized that forever by their continuing religious practice of not stepping on the threshold. There is a reference later in Scripture, in Zephaniah, to Jews, I believe, or maybe it's to the Philistines. It's either to the Philistines or to the Jews practicing Philistine practices. In Zephaniah, there's a reference to those who leap over the threshold, and it's a reference to this practice also. In Zephaniah 1:9, I'm sorry, I'm looking at Zechariah, that's the problem. Zephaniah is what I'm looking for. There we go. Verse 8 and 9 says, "And it shall be in the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's children, all such as are clothed in foreign apparel. In the same day I will punish all those who leap over the threshold, who fill their master's houses with violence and deceit." This is a reference to the Jews, because the prophecy of Zephaniah is against going into Babylon. But apparently the Jews had taken on some Philistine practices. Leaping over the threshold was a pagan practice of the Philistines, and apparently the Jews had begun to practice that in their own temple worship. Now, what's interesting about this is that God holds it against them that they do it. It's not as if God thought, that was pretty cool, these people check out and see how these other pagans worship their God, and we incorporate those into our worship of Jehovah. Oh, the Philistines, they honor the threshold of the temple. Well, we'll honor the threshold of Jehovah's temple that way. They won't step on it, we won't step on ours either. Then, and they begin to practice in their worship of Jehovah the things that they borrowed from pagan religions, which is something that God obviously did not approve of, and he was offended by, which in principle is instructive to us, because there are many Christians who feel that they can enhance the worship and service of God, maybe even enhance the fulfilling of the Great Commission, by borrowing from the world the things that they do in their idolatry. Does the world idolize rock musicians? Well, we can set up Christian rock musicians as idols and draw big crowds that way. You know, they can dress like and act like the secular rock musicians. Now, by the way, I'm not against rock and roll being used for Christian purposes. I am against the rock and roll scene being duplicated. The secular rock and roll scene is very corrupt, very man-glorifying, very idolatrous. And I am against that coming into the church, and yet it's very much encouraged in Christian circles. It draws big crowds and so forth. And oh, isn't that what Christianity is all about, is drawing crowds to Jesus? Apparently he didn't think so. He spent his time trying to thin the crowds, it seems to me, as I read the Gospels. But anyway, there, you know, all kinds of stuff is borrowed by the church from the world, because that's how the world serves its idols. And so we can maybe benefit the kingdom of God by doing the same kind of worldly stuff and just dedicate that to God. Now, there's to my mind, there's grounds for ambiguity or even controversy on the question of Christian holidays. We right now have Christmas approaching, and most of you know that most of the things that are done in celebration of Christmas are throwbacks to pagan practices. The decorative trees and so forth, and the good gifts on December 21st, was before Christians conquered Europe. Those things were practiced throughout Europe in memory of Tammuz and basically Babylonian and Roman gods. It was a pagan celebration, and it was celebrated precisely in the same way that we celebrate Christmas, on the same day. The early apostles never celebrated Christmas, as far as we know, and they never even preserved for us a knowledge of what day Jesus was born. We don't know when Jesus was born. But December 25th began to be celebrated the way it is because the church found it was hard to convert the Romans from their old pagan practices on December 25th. So the church decided, we'll just call that the birthday of Jesus, and they can still do all the same things they did before. We'll just say that we're doing this to celebrate the birth of Jesus instead of the birth of Tammuz, you know, or whatever. And since then, of course, it's become traditional for hundreds and hundreds of years to celebrate Christmas in this pagan way. Now, there are two ways this could be argued, pro or con, doing this. On the one hand, many people, I incline a little myself this way, but I'm not too legalistic about it, actually. We sometimes will have more or less traditional Christmas celebrations in our home. Sometimes we, like last year, we didn't do anything. Didn't have a tree or anything, and we often don't. In fact, for most of the years of my life, we haven't. But sometimes we'll get a tree. Sometimes we'll get it after Christmas. or get it before Christmas, take it down before Christmas or something. The kids like trees. But the thing is that it can be argued that it's wrong to introduce pagan practices in a Christian worship celebration. But against that view, we can say, well, the Bible no bans at all the memory of Jesus' birth. And since it doesn't give us some other way of doing it, since the commemorating of Jesus' birth is optional, I mean, it's not something commanded in Scripture, there's really nothing that the Bible would forbid about doing it in any particular way. It's strictly something the Bible's silent about. And some actually think it's great that we've taken over the pagan customs. And that's a mark of Christianity having conquered the pagan world. You know, the pagans used to do these things to honor pagan gods. Now these things are done to honor Jesus. And they say, well, this is not a matter of Christian ideas being co-opted by the world. It's the opposite. The world has been conquered by Christianity, and we have taken over their activities and consecrated them to Christ. Some people think that's a positive thing. I must confess, I think there's two sides to this argument. I don't know that anyone should be legalistic in their in what they say about the celebration of Easter or Christmas. I've never been into holidays myself, and I think that if anyone does make too much of it, it should be abandoned. If somebody feels like they can't enjoy Christmas without a Christmas tree, then their Christmas tree is an idol. And they ought to celebrate Christmas without it or not celebrate Christmas at all. There's not one reason biblically to celebrate Christmas. I mean, we can be very happy that Jesus was born, but to take a certain day of the year and celebrate his birthday on that day is, strictly speaking, extra-biblical. No early Christians that we know ever did such a thing until about the 4th century, and Jesus never encouraged it. So, I don't know, some people say, well, you celebrate your own birthday, you should honor Jesus at least as much as celebrate his birthday. Well, I don't really celebrate my birthday either, so celebrating Jesus' birthday or anyone else's isn't that big a deal. I've never been into holidays that much. But I am saying that the question of how people do celebrate Easter and Christmas may well be, we should perhaps look at it critically enough to say, well, is it really pleasing to God for us to co-opt these pagan practices and say, well, the pagans worship their God this way, let's worship Jesus with the same practices. That's just the kind of thing that God forbade the Jews to do. He said, don't ever check out what the pagans are doing worshiping their God and say, let's worship Jehovah this way. In Deuteronomy, he forbade that. And as we saw in Zephaniah, God was apparently not pleased that the Jews began leaping over the threshold of their Jewish temple, just like the Philistines had done to honor their temple. And anyway, all this comes up because we see the origin of that practice of the Philistines here. And what it really, you know, the bottom line here is that the Philistines continued to honor their God and leap over their threshold as a permanent practice thereafter. But really, what that signified was not really Dagon's superiority. But the reason they did is because Dagon lost that confrontation with the Ark. The Ark of God, or the present God, actually judged Dagon. So by the continuing practice of leaping over their threshold, the Philistines basically were inadvertently acknowledging the superiority and remembering the superiority of Jehovah over their God. By the way, I think that unbelievers who celebrate Christmas and Easter are doing the same kind of thing. They are, in a sense, no matter how they celebrate it, just by acknowledging it, just by acknowledging that Christmas is a day they should take off work and then go to a party or whatever they do. You know, even if they don't worship Jesus at all, just making Christmas a special day in the year is acknowledging something significant about Jesus. If I were an atheist and thought Christianity was really bad stuff and really opposed to Christianity, I would never celebrate Christmas. If I went to party, I'd pick another day to party. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want to endorse the notion that Jesus was that important, that we should all take a day off work and have a party. Even if we're partying in the most, you know, lascivious and drunken way, it is still the fact that we're doing it on that day because that is Christmas. And because we are honoring a particular day and the meaning of that day is that Jesus was born, if I was opposed to Christ, if I was opposed to Christianity, I would not want to celebrate Christmas in any way. Just like we don't celebrate Halloween in any way. Our family doesn't. We don't have Christian alternatives to Halloween. We don't have a harvest party or whatever that we go to. We just ignore Halloween. It's a satanic holiday. We don't care to honor Satan in any way. We're not going to co-opt it for Christianity. If we want our kids to have candy, buy them candy the day after or the day before or some other day of the year. But if I were an atheist and opposed to Christianity, I would certainly not even notice. I'd pay no notice of Christmas or of Easter. And even though there are people who reject God entirely in their lives, many of them acknowledge by having parties and by taking days, you know, taking the day off work or whatever, that the birth of Jesus is something to notice, something important, something worth having a holiday about, you know, and the resurrection of Jesus too. And while these people may not even believe in Jesus, the very fact that they celebrate Christmas or Easter is self-condemning. It condemns them because they're acknowledging the significance of the birth of Jesus implicitly by taking a holiday, but they're not living in the reality of the importance of Jesus, and therefore they condemn themselves. They'd be wiser and more consistent to just ignore the holiday. Well, the Philistines would have been wiser to ignore the fact that Dagon's head and hands had been on the threshold, because that was a testimony to his inferiority. It was a testimony to his impotence before the God of Israel. But they'd celebrate it anyway. So in the Philistine religion, there was a constant practice memorializing the superiority of Jehovah over Dagon. Verse 6, but the hand of the Lord was heavy on the people of Ashdod. Not only the idols in their temple, but the people themselves began to get sick. He ravaged them and struck them with tumors, or hemorrhoids. Actually, what I think it says in the Hebrew, it says tumors in their secret parts in the Vulgate. those are called hemorrhoids. In the hemorrhoids, or emerods, it's an older version of the same word. But he struck them with hemorrhoids, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how it was, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for hand is harsh to us, and Dagon our God. Therefore they sent and gathered to themselves all the lords of the Philistines and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they answered, let the ark of God of Israel be carried away to Gath, another one of the five Philistine cities. So they carried the ark of God away. And so it was, after they had carried it away, that the hand of the Lord was against the city of Gath with a very great destruction. And he struck the men of the city, both small and great, and tumors broke out on them. Therefore they sent the ark of God to Ekron, another of the five cities of the Philistines. So it was, as the ark of God came to Ekron, that the Ekronites cried out, saying, they have brought the ark of God of Israel to us to kill us and our people. So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines, and said, send away the ark of God, of the God of Israel, and let it go back to its own place so that it does not kill us and our people. For there was a deadly destruction throughout all the city, and the hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were stricken with the tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So there were not just tumors, there was a lot of death. Many people think that this was essentially the bubonic plague. One of the reasons is, although there's been no mention of rats or mice in chapter 5, when we come to chapter 6, there is mention of the fact that mice and rats had plagued the cities where the ark went. And bubonic plague was carried by fleas on rats, basically. I mean, black plague and the bubonic plague and these horrible plagues that decimated the population of Europe a couple hundred years ago. These were basically spread by flea bites, carried on rats mostly. And where there's a lot of rats, there's a lot of times plagues of this kind come. And a lot of the people died. And the ones that didn't die had tumors on them in their secret parts. And also there were rats. So some people put all that together and say maybe this was an outbreak of the bubonic plague. Whenever the ark came, God caused a rat infestation followed by the plague. That is perhaps partially giving a natural explanation to it, and maybe that's not the right way to do it, although it would still be supernatural. The plague would fall the ark. There's nothing about the presence of the ark that would naturally cause rats to reproduce in greater numbers. So it's it's like the Pied Piper, you know, wherever it goes, the rats follow. But I think that it's obviously supernatural, but it may have been a supernaturally invoked outbreak of the bubonic plague, as some people. Now the ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months, chapter 6, verse 1 says. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners, saying, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it to its place. They were tired of it. All of their cities kept getting this plague whenever it went. So what are we going to do with it? So they said, the diviner said, if you send away the ark of the Lord God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return it to him with a trespass offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand has not been removed from you. Then they said, what is the trespass offering that we shall return to him? And they answered, 5 golden tumors. These people were into images big time, you know. Make an image of your hemorrhoids out of gold. And 5 golden rats, according to the number of lords of the Philistines. That doesn't sound very flattering to the lords of the Philistines. Make 1 rat to represent each of the lords of the Philistines. 5 golden rats, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague on all you and your lords. Therefore you shall make images of your tumors, images of rats that ravage the land, and you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from you, from your gods and from your land. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? Boy, this thing that happened 480 years earlier, the Exodus, is still fresh in the minds of a lot of these pagans. It was a big deal. Almost a half a millennium earlier, God had smitten Egypt, but it was memorable. And everyone remembered that God had done it. So why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts when he did mighty things among them? They did not let the people go that they might depart. Now therefore make a new cart and take 2 milk cows which have never been yoked and hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them. Then take the ark of the Lord and set it on the cart. Put the articles of gold which you are returning to him as a trespass offering in a chest by its side and send it away and let it go. And watch, if it goes up the road to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. But if not, we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It was by chance that it happened to us. They consider that's a possibility, at least. Maybe it's just a coincidence that everywhere the ark went, this happened. We can't be sure it was Jehovah who did, but we'll find out this way. Now, they took 2 milk cows, which means they had calves, and they were bearing milk, bringing forth milk, producing milk, and they took the calves home away from the mothers. Now, of course, the natural instinct of the mothers would be drawn to where their calves were. Furthermore, the cows had never been yoked, so they would not be accustomed to pulling a cart. They've never done this kind of work before. They'd be chafing. If they were not trained under the yoke, they would not naturally pull in the same direction with each other. They'd just be pulling away, trying to get out of the yoke, and so forth. So, in other words, if not for supernatural intervention, these cows would not cooperatively pull this cart back to the land of Israel. They would tend to go to where their calves were. They'd be not pulling cooperatively under the yoke. They've never been yoked before. They hadn't been broken. Therefore, they said, if they end up going away from where their calves are and cooperatively pulling this cart to the place where the ark came from, we'll know that God is doing this, that this is the Lord who's doing it, and it'll confirm that it's he who's been smiting us. If this doesn't happen, then we'll just see that it was a coincidence. Then the men did so. They took the 2 milk cows and hitched them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they set the ark of the Lord on the cart and the chest with the gold rats and the images of their tumors. Then the cows headed straight for the road to Beth Shemesh and went along the highway, lowing as they went. They did the right thing, but they were groaning about it the whole time. And you imagine they would. Someone I know made a sermon based on this story about ministers who have put their head in the yoke to take Christ's yoke upon them. And a lot of times they have to leave family members and they have to leave, they have to go against their natural inclinations to obey God. And they go, but not without grief, not without heartache. And here we have the cows lowing, moaning as they go away from their calves and to their own death, really. They ultimately get sacrificed to the Lord. It made a good sermon illustration. And did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them to the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, and they rejoiced to see it. I bet they did. I mean, imagine that. The ark's been captured. Jews don't ever expect to see it again. And they're out working the field, and they see this cart coming, their ark, solid gold ark glistening in the sun. I bet that was a blessing to them. Then the cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stood there. A large stone was there, so they split the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. Those cows had a bad day. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the chest that was with it, in which were the articles of gold, and put them on a large stone. Then the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices the same day to the Lord.
So when the five lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron the same day. That was the end of their interest in it. They saw that indeed God had reclaimed the ark, and they figured their plagues would go away now. No doubt they did. Now these are the gold tumors which the Philistines returned as a trespass offering to the Lord, one for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, one for Ekron, the five cities. And the gold rats, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and country villages, even as far as the large stone of Abel, on which they set the ark of the Lord, which stone remains to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. Then he struck the men, this is a hard saying, then he struck the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck 50,070 men of the people. And the people lamented because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. Now, this verse is difficult for two reasons. One is it seems excessively severe on God's part to smite 50,070 men. For merely looking into the ark. Now, we know at a later date, God struck Uzzah dead for touching the ark.
He wouldn't have been quite afraid to get that many people.
Well, that's another problem. Well, one of the problems is, could this really be true? Could there have even been 50,000 men in Beth Shemesh? Was it that big a city? It's a little agricultural village. Where'd these 50,070 men come from? And how did that many people look into the ark? Did they have a line, a procession where everybody went in? You know, they made a contraction and went through and looked through. The answer is hard to answer. Let's put it this way. As far as the logistics of it, if this number is the right number, and I'm going to suggest that it might not be because there is a textual problem here, but if this is the right number, if it was in fact 50,070 men, then it is possible that they made light of the ark, that they didn't treat it with the proper ceremony. It may have attracted people from all over. Outside the village, it may have become a national attraction, and thousands of people over the course of maybe a period of weeks may have come to visit it and look in it and treat it as some kind of a spectacle, when in fact its proper place was behind the curtain in the Holy of Holies. Now, like I say, the fact they didn't take it back to the tabernacle suggests the tabernacle may not have been in Shiloh anymore at this point, and may not have even been assembled yet at this point. They may have later set it up at Nob. For some reason, they didn't take it back to the tabernacle, but they may have made a spectacle of it, and it may have been something over a long period of time that a great number of people came to see it almost like a tourist attraction or a spectacle, and it was simply not treated with proper reverence. And the number of people that were smitten might, in fact, represent the number of people who were struck by it. However, one problem with this interpretation is that it does identify the people who were struck as people of Beth Shemesh, rather than people who were just visiting Beth Shemesh. So it sounds like the number of people who were smitten were locals, people locally there who looked into the ark. There is a textual problem here. By the way, the books of Samuel and Kings, of all the books in the Old Testament, are the ones that have the most textual difficulties in the original manuscripts. And some scholars believe that the 50,000 is not a correct number. You'll notice there's a marginal reading there at verse 19 in your New King James. Another possible reading of it could say, he struck 70 men of the people and 50 oxen of a man. Which 50 oxen of a man is a strange reading. But apparently the word thousand there, after 50, he struck 50,070 men. the word thousand in the Hebrew, it's questionable in the various manuscripts, and it could be apparently rendered oxen of a man. And it might mean the man who opened the ark, God struck, judged him by striking his oxen. You know, he might have been a cattle herd, and he had, you know, 50 oxen. God struck them all, and 70 men also for looking in the ark. Now, that's a little awkward reading, but it is a possible alternate. And it would be much easier to imagine 70 men, local men, looking into the ark than 50,070 local people looking in the ark. And therefore, that textual reading that renders it 50 oxen of a man and 70 men were struck could conceivably be a correct alternate reading. We don't know. We'll never know until we go to heaven. So that would perhaps lighten the difficulty of the passage. Verse 20, and the men of Beth Shemesh said,
Who is able to stand before this holy Lord God? And to whom shall it go up before us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, The Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it with you. And so it was taken away, and we'll find it goes to the house of Abinadab. But we'll see next time, because we've just run out of time, and we've run out of chapter.